the beginning. Tell him to come on in. Is given by Mike Austin, who is assistant professor of English at Shepherd's College in Shepherdston, West Virginia. He finished his doctorate at the University of California, Santa Barbara, in English literature. He'll be speaking on Mormonism and multiculturalism, reflections on the Book of Esther, and this is in preparation for an article that he is going to, I hope, soon publish, which will become one of his series of articles that you may have seen. Turn the time over to Mike.
Okay. Actually, the Sufi comment I'm very grateful for, because I have a Sufi introduction. And it's not that I know a great deal about Sufis, it just sort of worked into the introduction. I would just like to look out and look at all the faces here at Sunstone, waking up early, eating breakfast. I'm so glad you chose to come to this devotional. I'd like to begin talking about something that happened to me this semester, just a couple of months ago, something that I consider to have been a serious moral lapse on my part, something that I did that was wrong, and why I considered it to be so wrong. This was in my world literature class at Shepherd College, and this is one of those great Plato to Nato Western Civ classes, if it's Tuesday, it must be Cervantes structure, where you just go through great works from all of Western civilization, and because we're trying to be impressive and multicultural, and because we're trying to, you know, get with the program, we have also decided to add in as many non-Western texts as possibly can, to supplement the Western masterpieces that we teach. I was teaching, about halfway through the current semester, a Sufi Muslim text called The Conference of the Birds by Feridun Attar. And, you know, it's not an area of expertise of mine. It's something that I've worked up as I worked up the literatures of as many classes as possible to teach sophomores in a general studies class. But as part of the lecture that I was giving that day, I was trying to get across the difference between mystical religion and more normative, rule-governed, ritual-governed religious experience. And I gave a brief mini-lecture on religious mysticism and what that meant in the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic traditions. And I got a question that, that still fascinates me. And it fascinates me, my response to the question, because it wasn't what I was expecting. And the question was, somebody raised his hand and said, "Excuse me, Dr. Austin, so would Joseph Smith have been a religious mystic?" And as I said, my reaction to this question startled me, because I froze. I became extremely nervous. I didn't want to talk about it. I don't discuss my religion with my students generally. Most of them don't know that I'm Mormon or, you know, that much else about my personal life. And I not only did I not want to tell them I was a Mormon, I didn't even want to tell them that I knew a lot about Joseph Smith, because I was afraid they might guess. I found myself, very much to my surprise, surprised, not wanting to discuss it. So I put the question down. I said something silly, something that I seriously regret saying, some general comment about how, yes, there were certainly mystical elements in many 19th century religions performed. Next question. I didn't go into it. And that's something that's been weighing on me for quite some time, because, as I said, I think that that was a moral lapse on my part. And let me explain what I mean by that. I'm not worried about that because I'm afraid I wasn't a good missionary. That's not a concern of mine when I teach. I think it would be irresponsible for a teacher to try to proselyte a student through a question like that. I don't have some sort of Peter denying Christ guilt about denying my beliefs. I don't believe that all the typical things that one might feel that to be a moral lapse for. I don't feel in any sense that by doing that I was not being a good Mormon. I do, however, feel now, and I felt so almost as soon as I said it, that by responding that way to the question, I wasn't being a good teacher. And the reason is this. This is a question that I've often thought about. Was Joseph Smith a religious mystic? And I have an answer for that question. At least in my mind, it's fairly well studied out. Some of you may or may not disagree with that answer. I'm not going to give it now. I'm going to make you guess. But at least I have an answer to the question that I think would have really helped explain the difference between mystical and normative religion, or between the mystical and the regulation-driven religious experience. I could have seized on that question to explain a principle better than I was explaining it. Had the question been about Charles Taze Russell or Mary Baker Eddy or Ellen G. White or William Miller, I would have seized on it. I would have spent 5 or so minutes explaining something about that. I would have used it as a teaching opportunity. I had a great opportunity to teach by, in other words, put the bottom line here. I had a great opportunity to teach something to one of my, to 80 of my students. This was the class of 80. By using my Mormon culture as the basis for that teaching experience, and I didn't do it because I felt extremely uncomfortable talking about my religion in a class. As a result, I didn't teach as well as I could have, and I believe that I was professionally irresponsible for having done so. And that's the kind of the observation, the self-observation that I'd like to take as the beginning of how I want to look at the Book of Esther in this devotional. Because I also teach the Book of Esther in this class. It's sort of a natural thing. I had just taught the Book of Esther a week earlier, and I taught it, as I always teach it, as the story of a religious triumph, of a young woman who acknowledges her Judaism and as a result saves her people, and the message being, you should acknowledge your religion and save your people, which is how I've always studied the Book of Esther, and I think it's a good message. And I believe that if all Mormons in this world were in danger of being exterminated, if I didn't acknowledge my religion, I would acknowledge it instantly. But that reading of Esther, even though I've taught it in church and Sunday school, and I've taught it in the literature classes for 3 years, has always disturbed me for two reasons. First of these is that Esther, of all the books in the Bible, Esther is probably the least religious. It's a story about Jewish culture in which God is not mentioned once. Kind of a corollary to the Book of Job. If Job is a book about humanity's relationship to God that doesn't mention Judaism, Esther is a book about Judaism that does not mention God. And it has become clearer and clearer to me that even though it's impossible with Judaism, as it is with Mormonism, to separate religion and culture in any meaningful way, because they are bound up together, and I recognize that they're all bound up together, Esther is, as far as it is possible to be in the Old Testament, a book about culture and about a heritage and a culture and a people that purposely, I believe, does not mention God or religious beliefs. Second reason that I've always had a problem with the reading of Esther as a great triumph is that by the time that she actually comes forward and acknowledges her Judaism, the stakes are so high, the stakes are so great, her entire culture is on the brink of genocide, that I think any decent person, I'm going to be stoned as a blasphemer here, but I think any decent person would have had to have done the same thing that Esther did. For this devotional, in other words, not to take away from Esther, which I think is a wonderful story, which I think is a very powerful story in the Jewish imagination and has become a powerful story in the Mormon imagination, by focusing on her triumph, her success, I want to focus this devotional on her initial failure to acknowledge her culture to King Ahasuerus, to the court, when Esther is first made the queen, you'll recall. I hope you all recall this, because you all know Esther. I'm not going to summarize Esther. I'm just assuming we have this as a shared text. Am I okay there?
We all recall.
You all recall Esther. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I always have to ask my sophomores, but I don't have to ask you. Esther becomes queen and does not, and she is Jewish. This is in the Persian Empire of Ahasuerus. She becomes the queen and does not mention her Jewish culture. Her cousin Mordecai specifically instructs her not to tell people that she's a Jew, because it might jeopardize what she has gained. It might jeopardize what she's become. And I really understand how Esther and Mordecai felt. And that's kind of the feelings I want to share here. Esther's failure there has been my failure for a very long time. Esther was uncomfortable because she was a member of a minority culture who had succeeded in spite of that fact and did not want to give people the impression that she was weird. You know, she didn't want to give people the impression that she was Jewish. She didn't know how they'd respond. She was afraid she would lose everything that she had. She was afraid that once people found out she was Jewish, she couldn't be queen anymore. Once people discovered her culture, they would hold it against her. And she, if nothing else, would always be marked with that stigma of being different. And I, you know, like I say, I understand this really, really well, because this experience, as I'm reading it, and I, of course, I admit that I'm reading it into my own circumstances. That's how I read things. But reading Esther and asking myself the question, why doesn't she just, you know, this is her husband. He loves her. He's chosen her from among all other women. We finally discover, when she finally does tell him about it, that he's happy about it and doesn't hold it against her. Why can't she just acknowledge her culture from the beginning? And I don't know, except that I know that I have had a very hard time with that too, as I've gone through graduate school. I'm remembering 7 years ago, when I first left BYU's master's program to start a PhD program in Santa Barbara, we all sat around in a circle, and we all had to say where we got our bachelor's and master's degrees and what we were studying here in Santa Barbara. And I had a horrible moment of my life, as everybody else said. I went to Yale, Harvard, Michigan, Wesleyan, all of these different colleges, and it got to me, and I said, Mike Austin, and I went to BYU. I tried as hard as possible to make it sound like NYU. Hard as possible. And then when... Because I didn't want to, and it was because I didn't want, and because the questions that came were inevitable. After class, 20 people walked up to me and said, "We went to BYU. Are you Mormon?" And I said, "Yes, I am, but I often go to radical symposia, and I'm likely to be excommunicated at any moment." I wanted to make sure that they understood that I was part of a radical fringe and should not be identified with Mormon culture. At some point in my education in Santa Barbara, the duality between being a Mormon and being an academic began to weigh so much on me that I felt a call. I don't know. I felt driven to start writing articles, start writing a little bit on Mormonism from the academic standpoint that I've adopted, which is literature. All throughout BYU, I actually admit I rather scoffed at the idea of Mormon literature. I wanted nothing to do with it. Once I got to Santa Barbara, I found that unless I did something to mediate between my academic literary self and my religious self, I was going to go absolutely crazy. So in a fit of actual desperation, I wrote an article called How to Be a Mormo American, The Function of Mormon Literary Criticism at the Present Time, and submitted it to Dialogue, and never listed it on my vita. And then I wrote several more articles on Mormons in literature, specifically constructing titles that didn't have the word Mormon in it, so that when I put them on my vita, nobody would know. And this has sort of been my evolution into Mormon literature, has been trying to do it, trying to embrace my culture, but trying to hide that fact from my peers as long as possible. 2 weeks ago, this actually became impossible for me. After I'd already written this talk when this happened, but 2 weeks ago or so, about three members of my small English department of eight came up to me and said, "I understand, Michael, that you do Mormon literature studies. You know, that's really great, and we're really happy that you do that." I don't know why. I didn't know at the time why they had said this to me all at once. I later found out that the one colleague that I had, I'll use the metaphor here, come out to, which I think is a very appropriate metaphor, and there's a whole devotional in that, and that's for some time later, but I think that that's exactly how I felt. I felt that I was coming out as a Mormon scholar, that I, until this year, was on a three-year visiting professorship. My position was converted to a full-time tenure-track professorship just a few weeks ago. The department had a big meeting to decide whether or not to do this, and the one colleague who I had confided my Mormon literature studies to sold me out, told everybody about it in an extremely excited way, something along the lines of, this is a fascinating new and important area of scholarship. This is a colleague who is a professional Appalachian literature scholar herself, and said this is a completely legitimate thing, and Michael has done a lot of work in this, and this is one of the reasons that we need to hire him. And the department agreed. And I, you know, what happened to me was very similar to what happened to Esther. I had spent 3 years trying to make sure nobody knew that I did this stuff. And once they finally found out, they were positively excited about it. And I had kind of one of these revelations that it is possible to be professional and to acknowledge one's Mormon culture. Let me kind of explain. I told Gene I'd only go till 9:45, so I'm going to try to do this last half in 5 minutes. I've always believed in theory, but I'm actually coming to believe in principle as well, or in practice as well, that one of the duties that is imposed on citizens of a multicultural democracy, there are two duties imposed on citizens of a multicultural democracy, and I'm a big believer in multiculturalism as an academic discipline, as a social force, as a way to organize our lives. I have been converted to these principles on a variety of different levels. And the two duties that I associate with that, one is, first of all, the assumptions that I associate with this. Let me go there first. I'm not following my outline. The assumptions of multiculturalism to which I have been converted are three. First, that a diverse body of literature, art, and music expands our understanding of beauty and allows us to see important things in new ways. Second, that diverse approaches to problems give us a variety of possible solutions to choose from when we're faced with problems. And the third is that a genuine understanding of each other's cultures and value systems helps us to live together with increased respect and tolerance, which I genuinely believe is a good thing. These are the principles by which I have tried to live my academic life, and they carry with them two responsibilities. The first is the burden to treat other cultures respectfully, especially, I believe, historically underrepresented cultures, to do our best to accept them on their own terms, to learn more about them, to avoid judging them by our standards, and to value their contributions to all of the areas of our society. And I believe that is an important responsibility that all ethical people have. The second responsibility, however, is also implied, and that is the responsibility to share our culture, as a culture, with other people so that it too can be accepted on its own terms, so that its strengths can be added to the larger pools of experience from which the larger society draws our strength. I have in my life, quite frankly, been amazed at how many Mormon intellectual liberal scholars, including myself, have not been willing to concede to their own culture the same basic benefit of the doubt that most people would give to a tribe of Brazilian cannibals. And I mean that. To see it as a culture that is a valid culture, to see its institutions as institutions that function, institutions that work, and to realize that there is a tremendous scholarly value in understanding that culture on its own terms. And I hope everyone's clear that I'm not kind of standing up and advocating a kind of religious proselyting. I have very mixed feelings about that sort of thing. And heaven knows that there are plenty of Mormons in the world ready to share their religion as a religion. There are very few Mormons in the world willing to share their culture as a culture with other professionals and academics especially. Most conservative Mormons aren't even willing to acknowledge that Mormonism has a culture because they have a vague sense that that being a culture somehow interferes with the church being true. Most liberal Mormons spend most of their public lives trying to distance themselves from Mormon culture as fast as they can because they don't want people to know that they're kooky. And the vast majority of liberal Mormons who embrace Mormon culture almost always end up doing it here at Sunstone Symposiums. We'll talk that one later. We're the only people who ever know about it are other liberal Mormons. You know, many of us are willing to be Mormon, to embrace our Mormon culture here in front of people like us, but that's not where it does the most good. I would just like to close with my testimony. As I said before, that multiculturalism is true. and that multiculturalism places a burden on us to contribute as well as to take from the multicultural table by adding our culture and our experiences, which are as legitimate as anybody else's and as problematic as anybody else's, to the table. Mormonism may not be everything, but it is not nothing. And as professionals and academics and culturally invested people, I believe that we, like Esther, have a responsibility to share that. And I say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
It may or may not tell you something about differences between Michael and me, that I also teach Esther in a world literature course I just did last fall at UVSC. But I focus on a different moral figure than Esther's. I focus on the fact, as you remember, that at the end of the story, the minority that had faced genocide turn on the majority and wipe them out. They take revenge on the revengers, and I think there's some lessons there for Mormons as well. Having once been a persecuted minority in Utah, we are sometimes relishing in our role as a majority culture in charge and taking some interesting kinds of revenge.
The difference is you live in Utah, I live in West Virginia.
That's right. That's a very important difference. I do want to talk about something that's very similar to what Michael's been talking about, and that is the tension between being a Mormon and being a human. So let me read this to you. We just have time for that. On being Mormon and human. I grew up feeling that because I was Mormon, I was different from other humans. I was special, even peculiar, separate, better than them. I sang, "I might be envied by a king, for I am a Mormon boy." And history began in 1820 with Joseph Smith's first vision. The little valley in southern Idaho where we raised dry land wheat was completely, unquestionably Mormon. And my life of working on the farm and going to school with my friends right across from the church, then going with the same friends to our Mormon meetings, was a seamless, safe whole. Even the programs I listened to each evening, lying on the coal linoleum under the huge Philco radio, easily confirmed my complacent values. Do you remember this one? Jack Armstrong, Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. How many have ever heard that? Well, I haven't outlived you all. We had our garden and cow and the wheat to grind for flour, so the Great Depression seemed far away, even when unsmiling hobos made it to our place far from the railroad and steadily chopped wood for an hour for a packed lunch. World War II seemed barely to touch us. The Moore boy from next door shot through the chest on Okinawa, coming home to testify he had been saved by God so he could later go on a mission. The regular front page maps in the Deseret News marking the quick expansion outward of Germany and Japan, and then the slow retreat of evil so the gospel could be taken to the world after the war. My repeated rounds of uncomplicated work and provincial faith came together as my father took me into the young wheat in the spring to kneel and ask God to bless and protect the crop. He promised the Lord to give it all beyond our basic needs to build a church and kingdom, and I felt assurance of God's approval of that consecration that has never left me. We moved to Salt Lake City when I was 12, coming back to the farm in the summers until my late teens, but meanwhile entering a new world. As I studied literature and art and history and science at East High and the U of U, I found many humans whose minds and hearts seemed very much like my own, and who often were superior to me in some ways, at least. Later, when I went away to Samoa and Boston and California and London, I became united in friendship with people who were completely non-Mormon, merely human, that I recognized as kindred spirits, loved and admired, and became convinced were better than I was in every way, including faith and righteousness. I became increasingly perplexed. Was my fundamental loyalty to the lovely, unified truths that had been given by God to Mormon prophets, or to the exciting, diverse new ones I was learning from the full range of human curiosity and dreams? I had been enraptured with Mormon cosmology from age 8, when my father, talking constantly as we worked together, began to describe how humans were not created out of nothing by God, but had non-destructible, inherent existence like our heavenly parents. Like them, we were engaged in a journey that stretched from long before this life and into a future without end of learning and struggle and joy and growth, even a journey towards godhood. Better than those of any other religion or philosophy I could find, these ideas helped me come to some peace with the mystery of evil. They helped me exult in the fruitful, exasperating, equal opposition of male and female. They helped me even to find joy and growth in transcendent spiritual experiences in my Mormon church service, where there was no separation of lay and clergy, ministers and consumers, but all were engaged as equals in struggling and learning to love together. But was my identity centered in these great and peculiar ideas and practices that, I realized, were available only to the 0.1% of God's children who were Mormons? Or was I mainly human, part of the great congregation of all those God has created and blessed with a saving and ongoing mercy? A God who, even as my own Mormon scriptures testified, had already revealed and was still revealing himself, quote, unto all nations. This perplexity came into sharp and disturbing focus when I served in 1981 as one of the directors of the Brigham Young University Study Abroad program in London. I quickly began to feel deeply both the division and the connection between being Mormon and being human. Along with students, I was ravished by the artistic beauty and spiritual devotion produced by the ancient and contemporary human cultures that we were for the first time so intensely studying and experiencing. Similarly, our Mormon heritage became more clear and precious as we visited the sites of the early missions of the apostles to Preston and Manchester and Herefordshire, as we learned of the conversion and emigration of tens of thousands, including many of our own ancestors, and the sacrificial devotion and now burgeoning diversity of the British church that remained, and as we felt the Spirit of the Holy Ghost in our own devotionals and conversations. Sometimes being Mormon and being human seemed in sharp conflict. The utilitarian architecture and bland art reprints in our chapels and temple were overwhelmed by the superior genius and vision of the English Perpendicular style at Wells Cathedral and the stained glass glories of Notre Dame and the challenging religious depth of the works of Giotto and Raphael and Michelangelo in Italian churches. Yet as we visited their sparsely attended services, we sometimes felt vastly superior to the Anglican and Lutheran and Catholic state churches, mired in apostate ideas, we thought, and in apathy, not even enough members and tithe payers to keep the great cathedrals and churches in repair. I visited the villages in Somerset and Dorset counties where my ancestors had lived. In the ancient parish churches where they had worshipped and some were buried, I imagined again the convictions that had moved my great-grandparents to cut ties of family and land and culture and risk death to go into exile in a desert thousands of miles away. I stood in the 14th-century manor house next to the Mormon temple near Lingford, Surrey, and thought of my parents living there for 3 years in the 60s as priest and matron, administering sacred ordinances and organizing hundreds of volunteer workers and teaching thousands of missionaries who came for special sessions. I went each Sunday to the Hyde Park ward and saw the congregation of gradually deepening and brightening in color as the 1978 revelation giving blacks the priesthood began to produce more and more dark-skinned converts from London and West Indies and the West Indies and Africa, some who came in flamboyant native dress. I watched lay leaders and teachers working together to overcome barriers of unequal, even antagonistic education, of stark cultural and language differences, and growing in patience and charity as they helped others do the same. I went home teaching with a man from Lebanon to a family from Jamaica with little English. We gave a priesthood blessing to an extremely sick daughter with words the parents didn't fully understand, then sorrowed with them. One Saturday, as a group of us from Hyde Park Ward got ready to go by rented van to the temple, the reserved English gentleman asked to pray softly said, "Please, Father, help us as we drive today not to do anything to hurt anyone." In our humanities and history classes, we taught the details of Christian history and architecture and art, then visited the sites and museums throughout London and the continent and Israel. We stood under the steeple of Salisbury Cathedral and thought of the faith and aspiration that could sustain artisans and tithe payers through whole lifetimes to lift those tons of stone 400 feet into the sky. We found a small Orthodox church on a back street in Moscow and worshipped with a few old women and one young couple as they kept the faith alive at great cost under communism. We stood in the dark and protective alcove of the National Gallery in London before Da Vinci's drawing of St. Anne, the mother of Mary, holding Mary and Jesus on her lap, her elegant and haunted face looking at and beyond us as her left hand, barely visible, gestures upward. And then in the Louvre stood before Da Vinci's final painting, the one he kept with him until death, of John the Baptist looking at and beyond us with the same face as St. Anne's, his right hand gesturing upward in that same supreme symbol of art's ability to point beyond itself. And we stood in the grotto under the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem and looked at the silver star on the floor marking the spot where Jesus was born, according to a tradition going back beyond the Crusades. Our Mormon and Palestinian guides made me increasingly nervous by their too constant insistence that the sites we visited had, quote, strong tradition backing their claims. This is very probably Rachel's Well. This is most likely where Christ suffered in Gethsemane. The Garden Tomb, quote, fits more exactly the description than the traditional site covered by a Catholic church and has been confirmed, quote, by the feelings of modern prophets. But before long, I began to realize that the exactness of the sites was not important. What mattered is that devout Jews and Christians and Muslims and now Mormons by the hundreds of thousands have for many hundreds of years come to those sites to express and renew their faith, to kneel and weep by that silver star as I saw a Catholic priest doing, or leave a candle burning in the grotto at Gethsemane, the young Mormon girl with us did, or stand on the stairs looking into the torture pit in the palace of Caiaphas, where Christ may have been hung by his feet during that last night, and suddenly begin singing with new emotion an old hymn about following Christ, whatever the cost, as a group of Baptists on tour with us did. That was the miracle. At the end of our term in London, I was able to talk with the students about an enriching paradox, that our experience there could make us more committed to our specific, peculiar, and somewhat exclusive Mormon faith, and also, without contradiction, more grateful to and part of the great human experience with God that produced the art and buildings and the pilgrimages we had been witness to and participated in. Yes, we would continue to feel the tension, would move back and forth between the poles of being mainly Mormon and mainly human, sometimes with anguish. But we now understood with our minds and eyes and hearts that history, even our own religious history, began long before 1820, and could also value the unique movement toward God that began then and that we were part of. We could share the universal impulses and yearnings of the traditions we had studied and give particular creative expression to them through our own. We did not need to wander as strangers and foreigners among the struggling, sometimes backsliding, often stunningly generous people we met in London and Bethlehem and Moscow. We were fellow citizens with them, fellow saints in the human household of faith.
I think our chair has sort of
I think we were supposed to go back to that other.
Thank you for coming. Have a nice day.
We're all coming back to the auditorium now.
Good job. You're going to do that as a call of my head.